The writings of Philo of Alexandria are essential in terms of the development of the Christian conviction that the scriptures can themselves be the central source to which we turn in spiritual guidance, and that to a very great extent, the scriptures can themselves be the means by which we experience Christ, our spiritual guide. So the idea that the Bible can provide not only a model, but an experience of ongoing guidance, that there is a way of reading the biblical text that leads us into the presence of God, who then guides us, and who also enables us, through this experience of finding God in the scriptures, to find God also in other aspects of one's life. This tradition is very strongly rooted in the writings of Philo of Alexandria. Philo is a Jew who lives just a bit before the time of Jesus. He's something of a contemporary, although he lives considerably longer than the Lord, and their lifetimes do overlap. He never knew or knew anything of Jesus. He lives in Egypt. He's associated with the Jewish community in diaspora, that is to say, that is living outside of Palestine, although he and his family are strong supporters of the community in Jerusalem, and being a very wealthy family, we actually have a record that they contributed to the silver plating of part of the temple. Philo's writings represent a beautiful synthesis of Platonism, of the attempt to take seriously the philosophical insights and methodology suggested by Plato, and then to apply them to a completely different tradition, to the tradition of the Jewish scriptures. Philo is regarded not only as a Jewish writer and teacher, but also as one of the chief exponents of the philosophical tradition known as Middle Platonism, in which the insights and methods of Plato are applied to the later developing tradition, and in fact, Plato's own writings become gradually viewed as a sort of sacred text. Now, for Philo, there can be no doubt that the real sacred text is the Torah. The real sacred text is the Jewish scriptures. But he is very willing to use methods that are being used by Platonists to interpret Plato's writings, and indeed to begin to look out and interpret the universe itself according to insights and methods found in Plato's writings. Philo believes that these methods can be used also by Jews to enhance their own spiritual understanding. I've given selections from several of his writings. The first from his text, The Life of Moses. And if you look over a catalog of Philo's writings, you will find that a very large portion of them are really his own extended allegorical, spiritual, you might call them contemplative commentaries on the Torah, on the first five books of Moses, and especially on the most prominent themes in those texts. Indeed, his two books on the life of Moses are important sources for similar allegorical contemplative biographies of Moses that are important in the Christian tradition. And Philo was read by Christians. He was read especially by the Alexandrian Christians who lived in his own city and who regarded his writings as an important part of their spiritual heritage, especially people like Clement and Origen, and then some among the Cappadocian fathers, especially Saints Gregory of Nyssa. The writings of Philo, I might add parenthetically, were principally preserved by Christians until relatively modern times, when Judaism again began to be interested in them. Philo began to be regarded as something of a heretic in about the 2nd century AD, when the Jewish tradition began to strongly shift towards an exclusive approach to the scriptures that really came to abominate the Greek translation of the text, the Septuagint, which was Philo's principal text on which he commented. And Philo also began to be regarded as something of a betrayer because he had used foreign pagan philosophy to interpret Jewish tradition. But again, he is today a very prized source within Judaism, and many Jewish scholars have contributed a great deal to Philo scholarship. Let's look at this text on the life of Moses. What we have here is an allegory, a symbolic depiction of the three patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, as standing for what we can only call models or world views that allow one to see the whole of our endeavor as human beings. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob become models for the three great experiences of being taught, wisdom as he puts it, that is derived from teaching, that which is a didaktes. And second, Isaac becomes a symbol of natural wisdom, physikes, of physiki. And finally, Jacob becomes a model of ascetic philosophy, that which can be arrived from ascetic practice. And so you have three levels of knowledge, three levels of experience, that which we are taught, that becomes later associated with a kind of a contemplative model of God and theology beyond word, beyond image. Physiki, that which pertains to the natural order, the created order, the ability to perceive God present in creation, and a level that has to do with our ascetical practice, the so-called praktiki, the quest for virtue, the desire to expel vice. So for him, the idea of these three foundational patriarchs are allegories or symbols of three overarching ways of obtaining information of or perceiving the universe itself. They are a kind of a model of contemplation. Now, this will be interpreted in a different way. The three patriarchs' names will be interpreted in a different way in the Christian context, but the idea of this threefold method of a fundamental level of ascetical practice, of a moral level of experience and of meaning, a level of an ability to look at the created order and find God present in natural realities, created realities, and a third level that rises above all this, that can only be transmitted by teaching from God, remains an important context for the developing notion that it is in the scriptures that we perceive and learn to apprehend these three different levels. Then Philo goes on into other writings. The first we're going to look at, if you drop down and I've labeled it number two, is his writing, his text, That Every Good Man Is Free. And this is his symbolic and historical depiction of the Essenes, the Qumran community, which was only uncovered or discovered through its writings when the Dead Sea Scrolls were found. Is now believed to be the community that Philo is describing and calling Essenes. He describes this as a model community which is primarily interested in discovering in the scriptures the quest for ethical virtue. So that which he describes very theoretically in the text that we just looked at in the life of Moses, here he portrays as the goal of a whole Jewish community. A Jewish community of, and the Essene community turns out to be monks. There's no other way to describe them. Judaism had monks and nuns. Certainly the Essenes, if the Therapeutae actually existed, and they probably did, we'll get to them just in just a couple of minutes, then they also would be an example of Jewish monasticism, which existed at the time of Jesus and considerably before, but did not survive the destruction of Judaism after the destruction of the temple and the quelling of the Jewish revolts in the second century. But at the time that Philo's writing, these institutions are a going concern. They are ways in which one can say, ah, here is a group of people who have devoted themselves in a lifestyle to, and let's look at the text itself, he says, not to the logical part of wisdom or even to physiki, not even to trying to discover the nature of creation, but this is a group of committed Jewish ascetics who are looking for, as he puts it, the ethical part of the law. They use the ethical part of the text as a kind of a way of understanding God's will for them, using as their trainers their ancestral laws, that is, traditions of interpretation, of exegesis that they have received. And then he describes the fact that they are trained primarily on their gatherings on the Sabbath, at Sabbath day, effectively Bible studies, what would become in the rabbinic tradition and in the Pharisaic tradition, especially synagogue services. He describes, if you drop down a couple of paragraphs, one takes up the book and reads aloud, and another, not the reader, but another who is more practiced, who is more knowledgeable, explicates, interprets these texts. And so there is he calls it a philosophical study using symbols that follow an antique mode by which they grow in what he calls a love of God, love of virtue, and love of human beings. Philotheo, philareto, philanthropo. This is their goal through a study of the scriptures in which they seek primarily the ethical, the practical, the moral sense. Now, in contrast to this, number three, the third text that I've given you, is his description of the therapeutae. This is a different kind of community, a contemplative community, which exists primarily as solitaries. It would be delightful to spend more time looking at them in detail, but unfortunately we can't look at the fascinating depiction of them as people who live in solitary places, not too far from the city of Alexandria. He says that they live on an island in the Mareotic Lake. But they are seeking eremia, they are seeking solitude and koinonia, toward a fellowship with one another. The first use of the word monastery, monasterion, is found here in Philo in the paragraph that I've numbered 325, in which he describes their individual cells, the places where they gather together, but in solitude, each one of them has their own dwelling, and in this place they study the biblical text. So their source of spiritual guidance, the source that leads them forward, is meditation on, as he puts it, the laws, the oracles, the prophets, the psalms, and the other books. That is to say, what we would call the Old Testament. They study the scriptures and thus grow in spiritual knowledge, which he describes in 3:26. They keep the memory of God alive and never forget God, and twice daily they pray at morning and at evening. So Philo is describing morning and evening prayer, daily hours of scripture meditation as a way of life, which he is commending as a way of moving into the contemplative life, that there is a way of beholding God even within and beyond creation that is facilitated by the study of Scripture. This practice that in the later Christian tradition would be called Lectio Divina, he is strongly recommending to his Jewish confreres and portraying a model of people for whom study of the Torah is itself a way of being guided in the spiritual life. In section 328, he says that the whole interval between morning and evening is devoted to what he calls a spiritual exercise, and this ascesis, the spiritual ascesis, consists of reading the scriptures, applying themselves again to an ancestral philosophy, in other words, to rabbinic modes or models of interpretation. Philo is using both rabbinic and Platonic models of interpretation, finding allegorical or symbolical meanings within the hidden text, symbols, he puts it, of a hidden nature. And he explains in 329 that they make use of, they have available to them, examples, models from the past. This is the beginnings of the assembly of a rabbinic tradition that would eventually give rise to the Talmud and the Mishnaic texts. He also describes themselves as experiencing contemplation and then taking their contemplative experience based on the scriptures and applying it to the composition of chants and hymns. In 330, he talks about the fact that they do this all week long, but in 375, they come together for a Sabbath service analogous to what he's described for the Essenes, but here he describes it in a little more detail. The leader employs a leisurely mode of instruction, lingering, drawing things out through constant recapitulation, imprinting these ideas in the thoughts of the souls of his hearers. The interpretations in 378 of the scriptures are made, as he puts it, in allegory. So there is an allegorical exegesis that is here a lifestyle, not only an individual practice, but something in which the group is initiated by a leader and which provides them with a model for a mode of making spiritual progress. The beauty of concepts is beheld through the polished glass of the words. So this practice teaches them to view the text as a way of moving beyond the literal sense into the deeper hidden meanings of the scriptures. Now, the last two sections, the last two texts I've given you, number four from his book on special laws and number five on agriculture, are demonstrations of the fact that it is in Philo that we first encounter an image, a kind of a metaphor that becomes very important in the later Christian tradition of spiritual guidance, in which the holy Christian, the person who is practicing this art of using the biblical text as a way of deepening in relationship with God, of learning more about God, the world, and one's self. The metaphor that's used is, and it'll seem a little paradoxical for us, is the ruminant beast. That is to say, the beast that is in the Old Testament declared pure, and pure or clean because, and you see this in the first selection in the chapter that I've labeled 4:105, this beast on the one hand has a divided hoof, and he will say that this is a symbol of the ability to discriminate, to distinguish, to know right from wrong, to know what to pay attention to, and to know what to reject. And remember that we will be looking in our study of the developing tradition of spiritual direction and guidance at this art of discrimination or discernment, the ability to look at interior temptations and at choices in a way that allows one to discover, what is it that I should choose? The symbol for this is very often the clean beast, which has the divided hoof, that means it has the capacity to distinguish, to engage in this art of discernment. And it must also, he says, ruminate. It has to be able to engage in this practice that we would call meditation, and specifically biblical meditatio. So there's a union here already in Philo, already in the time of Jesus, which is then imported into Christianity, appropriated by the fathers and mothers of the tradition, and then especially used and applied in the Alexandrian spiritual tradition and in the writings of the desert fathers and mothers, to say that the pious Christian is like this ruminant beast that has the capacity to engage in discernment because it engages in Lectio Divina. Let's just look at Philo's depiction of this tradition. If you drop down, he, in the second paragraph of 4:104, he says, the beast, this symbolic capacity, means that the divided hoof, this ability to distinguish, means that one is capable of separating the better things from the worst things, knowing good from bad. And then he uses the model of rumination as a model for, as he puts it in the next paragraph, to revolve within the mind that which we hear through continuous meditation, through melete, and we'll find this word used specifically to describe the Lectio Divina tradition in Christianity. You revolve within yourself what you hear in the biblical text through melete, and that gives you the ability, the skill to, as he puts it, discriminate. And he uses the word, not the word with which we will become most familiar, diakrisis, which is the word that is most often used in the later Christian monastic tradition to describe this ability. He doesn't use the word diakrisis, he uses diastole, to distinguish or discriminate or determine. He also uses the term diairesis to describe this ability to know the difference between what is to be done and what's to be avoided. He uses the same image in the final text that I've offered on agriculture, which seems rather odd to us, but it's his way of talking about some of the images in the Old Testament that describe foods used for sacrifice and various other things connected with the tradition of sowing fields. And here again, he brings up the image of the clean and unclean beast, and we'll look at this very briefly. In 5:132, he talks about rumination as being a quiet revolving within oneself in tranquility, in hezukia, a very important word in the later Christian monastic tradition, which enables one to, and again this word diastele, to separate the advantages within memory of that which is good from that which he says is here is mischievous or problematic. So there is a distinguishing of the nature of things that is enabled to happen because one ruminates. Well, here we have in Philo, in this contemporary of Jesus, what we can only call an approach to biblical meditation that allows the Bible to be a means by which one learns how to become a meditator on the biblical text, and one who learns the art of discernment, who learns the art of what he calls discrimination or distinguishing. The scriptures themselves teach us through a process of learning multiple levels within the text to discover a what we can only call a literal sense of the scriptures, a moral, and a and also an allegorical or deeply symbolic sense, and a notion that as we do this, we grow in the capacity to learn to discriminate in our ordinary lives what exists. So effectively, Philo is presenting a model that will become very prominent in Christianity, that this method of exegesis ultimately also becomes a means of understanding one's own innermost self. One takes this art and then applies it to what is going on within oneself and ultimately to the world outside the self.